It's my privilege to introduce Steve Haynes. I've come to know him a little bit, and we've traded stories, and many of you know Steve. And if you haven't read the book, The Last Segregated Hour, I hope you will read it because it's very well done. He's the at Rhodes, and he's been there since 1989, and doing a wonderful job of raising issues around the faith that are important that we look at. So with that, I'd ask you to please welcome Stephen Haynes, and he'll introduce some other folks.
My wife said to make sure I button my jacket, so let me take care of that. Okay, I'm going to stand up here. I feel a little distant, but I also feel like you can probably see me better. I just want to say that for me, this is an emotional moment. I had some tears this morning. And it's because I just feel the amazing gift it is to give this presentation in this place. This is something I never thought or really even hoped would happen. And the fact that it's happening is not lost on me. I feel very humbled by it. I also am humbled by the presence of some people I want to recognize before I forget, before we get started. Jim Bullock and Irvin Bullock are here. These are all people who were in front of the church 50 years ago on this day. Lillian Hammond Brown is here. I think, please recognize her. Vivian Carter Dillahunt is here. And as you'll learn in a minute, one of the first two to come on the 22nd of March, 1964, was Joe Purdy. Joe's sister, Carolyn, is here as well. I don't want to recognize her. Are there any other folks that I have missed that who were here at that time who need to be recognized? Please, if so, let me know. Okay. So when I do this presentation, typically I start in 1960, which is the place where Neelands began in Atlanta, as it turns out, and sort of spread in a ripple effect through a lot of southern cities, including Memphis in 1960. And that story is interesting in itself, but I want to start, for time's sake, with 1964 and the events that we're here to commemorate. Just to cut right to the chase, the two people in Memphis who were most responsible for managing and inspiring the young people who were the soldiers in the nonviolent movement were Maxine Smith and James Lawson, here pictured together in a march. They were quite different people, and yet they got along well, worked well together, according to both their testimonies. Maxine, as many of you know, was the executive secretary of the NAACP and was involved from the beginning, from 1960, for sure, from March 1960, when the sit-in movement began here. Although she told me that the truth of it is that the students would decide what to do and then call her from jail asking to be bailed out. Nevertheless, she got a lot of credit or blame for what they were doing. The other important figure in the Memphis movement was James Lawson, who moved here in 1962 after a somewhat colorful career in Nashville and other places. James Lawson was not a Southerner. He was a pastor in a so-called white denomination, the United Methodists. He was a conscientious objector during the Korean War. He had done prison time for that, had visited India to learn from Gandhi, and had been expelled from Vanderbilt Divinity School for his role in training the students who were involved in the 1960 sit-ins there. He was actually reinstated because, I'm happy to say, since this is my alma mater, I'll tell the story, the entire Divinity School faculty resigned in protest, and he was reinstated. The bishop decided to put him safely away from Nashville in Memphis, where he wouldn't get into any trouble. That turned out to be a misjudgment on the bishop's part. What Lawson did in Memphis is the same thing he did in so many other places throughout the country, and that is that he led these nonviolent direct action workshops. He did them for SCLC and SNCC and other civil rights organizations. He did them at churches. And when he came to Memphis to Centenary United Methodist, he led these workshops in the basement of his church This is an ad from the in March 1964, an announcement in the Commercial Appeal about these workshops which were going on at that time. This is the only picture I can find of Lawson actually doing one of these, and this is in Ohio in preparation for Freedom Summer in 1964. So one of the things that the students who stood out in front of the church had in common is that they met in either Maxine's intercollegiate NAACP group or they met in one of these workshops that James Lawson put together. And recall that particularly for the white students, the Southwestern students, they were not accustomed to civil rights activism. This was something very new. And I can only imagine that when they got to Lawson's workshop and they were handed this pledge, they thought twice and maybe three times about what it is they had gotten themselves involved in. I won't read it to you, but you can read it. And it's very much a spiritual task that they're taking on, but it's one that requires not only a spiritual commitment, but a bodily commitment. And one of the misnomers about direct nonviolence is that it's assumed, rightly perhaps, that it was supposed to be nonviolent. It almost always turned to violence, because the point of nonviolence was to provoke the violence inherent in the system which is being opposed. And so when people came to the church or anywhere else, they knew that it was a possibility, at least, that they would be mistreated. But the discipline of the movement was whatever happened, whatever was said or done to you, one remained in that nonviolent posture. This is a pledge that they took home with them. This is the group of radicals from Southwestern who were involved in the kneel-ins. And I found this picture of these radicals when they were posing for the yearbook picture for the Westminster Fellowship, which is the Presbyterian church group on campus. Here's Jim Bullock. Bo Scarborough is a local pastor some of you may know. There are others you may know. And I say radicals tongue-in-cheek because obviously they look pretty square, pretty conservative, and they were actually students at a segregated Presbyterian college at the time. So keep in mind what they look like here and then the kind of portrayals that were presented of them by members of the church. In these meeting places, the Lawson's nonviolent workshops and in Maxine Smith's intercollegiate NAACP chapter, some relationships were born. These are two Southwestern students, Earl Standback, who was actually at this time, they just finished high school at Melrose, and Joe Purdy, who was a student at Memphis State at 1964 graduation at Southwestern. And the fact that they're together in this picture in 1964 gives you a sense of the sort of relationships that had begun to form. Two of these students, Jim Bullock, who's here today and from whom you'll hear, and Joe Purdy, who is deceased but whose sister is representing him and his memory here, were among those who got involved in what the group members of the NAACP youth group called a church visit campaign. It was pretty simple. They got together in pairs and they decided to visit each other's churches. The way Jim tells it is that they went to Joe's church and Joe said, okay, well, let's go to your church. Jim, being the son of a Presbyterian minister, had sort of, this might not be fair, Jim can correct me, had sort of taken college off from church to some extent, visited several places, didn't have a church of his own, but when the time came to pick one, said, well, let's go to the largest church in the area and it'll give you a sense for what Southern Presbyterianism is about. So they came to this plant. The church had been here since 1947. It's, as you see, in a very prominent corner. This is a picture before it was fully built, but then as now, it's a very visible space outside. Before I tell you what happened to Joe and Jim, though, I have to explain something that many people, even in the church at the time, did not know. And that is that in 1957, the session of the church here had adopted a policy that made explicit its support of segregation and its opposition to any involvement of church members or representatives in integrated activities. The motion that was brought to the session that was approved in August was that the church go on record as being opposed to integration in our conferences and institutions, and that our staff be instructed not to attend or promote any meetings that are integrated. A few months later, in October of 1957, there was, and by the way, I've got two pictures here that to indicate what I think were some of the reasons for this policy being adopted when it was. One is Little Rock. The federal government was exercising its ability and its intention to enforce civil rights law not too far from here, a couple of hours from here. This gave people the fright. But it was also the fact that at the church level, at the denominational level in the Presbyterian Church, integration was taking place primarily, very slowly, and sort of organically in youth conferences, among college students, among women's groups. And so it was seen as a threat, not so much in the church, but in the denomination at large. This policy was made more explicit in October of 1967. One of the most interesting things about it is this first paragraph. If you were an evangelical Christian in the 1950s, and you say that the Bible doesn't really relate to what we're about to say, you are acknowledging a great deal. And I think what you're acknowledging is there's no biblical stance for this. If there were, we would certainly cite it. But we can't come up with one, so we're just going to say the whole question of whether it's biblical is moot. But in any case, this is going to be our policy. There's another interesting thing here which connects integration to communism, not just communism, but godless communism. And it gives a sense for how people, at least the people responsible for this document in 1957, were likely to view organizations like the NAACP, which to us seem fairly regularized, fairly normative, and not frightening, but at the time were seen as front organizations for a larger communist conspiracy. And then we really cut to the chase in this policy because they talk about mixed dancing between whites and Negroes at our conference grounds, and I think this is what really was driving this policy to a large extent. The prospect of kids from this church or other churches going to places like Montreat and interacting with African Americans, dancing with them, and the thought was if they dance, of course they'll have sex, and if they have sex, they'll have babies and so forth. And it's just a little bit of being facetious to say it that way. I think that was ultimately the fear. So not only were they unembarrassed by this statement, they sent press releases to the two daily papers to make sure it was clear. Here's one of the headlines. So there was no sense, at least in 1957, that the session of this church was in any way embarrassed by this stance or felt like it had to be defended. They just wanted to publicize it. So when Joe and Jim arrived at the church outside here in 1964 on March 22nd, 50 years ago today, they didn't know anything about the 1957 policy. They didn't know much about the church except its size and its prominence in the denomination. And they walked up, and Joe was asked, "Are you African?" To which Joe said, "No, I'm American." And then the person discussing this with them said, "Well, then you can't come in." I just have to say, as an aside, it took me years to figure out exactly what that conversation meant, what its significance was, but I'll explain it to you later if you would like some help figuring it out. And they had decided that if they were rebuffed, they would try to enter anyway, and so they walked toward the church steps. They were approached by security guards from the back. Instinctively, they knelt to pray, and the security guards didn't want anything to do with arresting them at that point, so let them leave. But when they left, they told their friends, and the next week they brought them with them. And for the next 7 weeks, consecutive weeks, there were lines of people, mostly young people, but some adults, standing out in front of the walkway in the church. This was to create a sort of spectacle of exclusion that people would see, people inside and out the church would see. As it turned out, not a lot of people inside the church actually saw it, because they knew how to get into the church while avoiding the front steps. So typically what we see is a lot of scenes like this with students standing outside, and if you see church people, they're looking at over from the corner of a building or something. These are some pictures that appeared in the newspapers, and there weren't a lot of them at the time. Here's another picture of Jim Bullock, some other of the students, they're leaving. How did the students strike you in terms of their dress and demeanor? Very appropriate. They look like they're going to church, don't they? So keep that in mind, because as we go through, I think you'll be struck by how their behavior and their appearance was depicted by those who didn't want them here. The only problem was this guy had a little bit of a beard, which was a little provocative in those days, but he kept it very closely clipped. This is a picture I just received recently from Jackie Hall, who was one of the demonstrators who found it somewhere. Again, you see the students leaving and men standing sort of on the side, making sure that they do leave. This is Howard Romaine. Howard couldn't be here today. He lives in Nashville and is very, very much involved, interested in this history. And Howard was, I think, probably the most instinctively radical of the group, most likely to do things that would get him in trouble. So he was asked by the security guard not to come on campus, advice he apparently ignored, because there was a picture in the Tri-State Defender of him being escorted off campus. No one was ever arrested, but it was clear that there were security guards present to remove people. There were also apparently threats of people having guns in their boots, in their glove boxes, and so forth. So there were some veiled threats of violence, although no actual violence. As it turned out, the school where Jim and some of the other protesters were enrolled, Southwestern at Memphis, had a very close relationship with Second Presbyterian Church that goes back to 1925 when the college came to Memphis. It was close at every level. A lot of students from here went to school there. A lot of kids from school there went to church here. To give you a sense of how close the relationship was, there was a fund drive that was announced in March of 1964, of all times. In the paper, $175,000, I don't know what that is in today's dollars, but several million probably. The three people who were in charge of the campaign were Peyton Rhodes, the president of the college, Van Pritchard, the head of the board of directors, and Jeb Russell, the minister here. So I can imagine that some conversations between those three were complicated during these months. The church, though, and perhaps because of its close relationship to the college, decided that the best way to stop what was happening in front of the church, these repeated visits, would be to just make it very clear to the college what was at stake. So there was a meeting at which the president and others were present. The spokesman for the church said, "We want you to call off your students. What they're doing is embarrassing us. They're standing in judgment on us. They have no business doing that. And by the way, if they don't, you're going to lose the support that we have so generously given you over the years." And Peyton Rhodes is supposed to have said, "Thank you for being clear about this. I'll pass this along to the students, but Southwestern is not for sale." And I say this every time I do this presentation. I'm going to say it again. I've known a lot of college presidents in my life. I've never met one who would say that. Because if that's your job is to not ever say that, right? I mean, your job is to do whatever it takes to keep that from happening. It probably should be said that Peyton Rhodes was in the last year of his 25-year career as president of Rhodes. So he maybe had more, was able to summon more courage than if he had been earlier in his career. But at any rate, it was a proud moment for the college, I think. But it was very frustrating for the people who had gone to try to work this out. It fell upon Alf Cannon to represent the position of the college in this. And poor Alf was not only the dean of development at Rhodes, but he was also a Sunday school teacher at Second Pres. He was one of those people, and there were many of them, who were connected to both institutions and felt very caught by this. He explains, I think, very well that this is a liberal arts college. We don't tell students what to do. We try to give them guidance for life. But the truth is, I met a woman, Catherine Freeberg, who in 1964 was her 25th reunion. She was responsible for raising money. She told me she got nothing. Nothing. Because people were either part of the church, alums were either part of the church, or they were so incensed at the college for not siding with the church, they decided until this is resolved, we're not going to give any money to the college. So the next step in this strategy of trying to end this thing was to contact the white students' parents. How did you do that? Well, you had to identify them. So there were some members of the Southwestern student body who went to school here who identified some of their colleagues. And letters were written to these students. And thanks to a student named Hayden Caden's mother, who saved all these things, I can show you what they looked like. All the students I've talked to, all the Southwestern students, confirmed that they got these letters, although they didn't keep them. So I'll let you read the letter as I speak, but I want to note something, a couple of things. One, it's written by someone, Robert J. Hussey, on his own company letterhead. This is someone who is not trying to be anonymous. And also, it's a pretty short letter, and it's pretty to the point. And I think what we need to understand about that is a white man in 1964 writing to another white man of the same age with a college-aged child assumed that this is all that needed to be said. Your son is involved with carrying around Negroes and doing things he shouldn't do. End of story, problem solved. It also indicates, by the way, that there were other ways of recognizing students, and one was using access to car registration records to find out the permanent addresses of these students. So the person who got the letter was actually Hayden Caden's stepfather, who happened to be a Presbyterian pastor in Houston. And this is the response that he sent to Mr. Hussey. I'll let you read it as I'm speaking. I don't know what response Mr. Hussey expected, but I'm very certain it was not this one. Basically, it gives him a lesson on the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, about what it means to be a church and what the possibility of a segregated church is, and then just talks about how proud he is of his stepson. I should say that Caden got a letter from his stepfather this same day, and the tone is very different. The tone was, listen, pal, if you're doing any of the things that are being said, you need to be careful. Keep in mind this letter, because as it turns out, it had repercussions far beyond just this family. The next attempt to put an end to this, as far as the Southwestern students went, was to send photographs to students' parents that were framed, taken with a Polaroid Land camera, which had just come out in 1963, and framed in such a way that they indicated sort of fraternization between white students and black students. And this is what the letter says. And by the way, it's again on personal stationery of a man named Willis Ayers, whose address is there. And he basically says to Hayden's mother, again, very laconically, very briefly, this is a picture, thought you'd like to see it. Not much had to be said in his mind because the evidence was there. So the letter he gets back, again, I don't know what he expected to get. It wasn't this. I mentioned this to Jim Bullock yesterday, and I asked Jim, did your parents get these letters, and what was their response? And he said, my mother said that she wanted to come stand outside with me. And I said to her, no, Mom, you can't do that. So Hayden's parents weren't the only ones that supported them. But this is the kind of thing that, you know, I'm sure Hayden is very proud of. It couldn't be expected that one's parents would respond this way, but some of these students were lucky enough to have that kind of support. So if you happen to be a child of a racial moderate like Jim Bullock or Hayden Caden, particularly if you're the son of a pastor, and a lot of kids at Southwestern at the time were, and it was your father was a pastor who had sort of faced pressures over integration and were used to how people dealt with them, you felt a lot of support. Not everybody was so lucky. I'll give you two examples of Southwestern students whose parents were not as understanding. One of them, Irvin Haas Bullock, who's here with us today, was summoned home to Mobile where her father was on a hunger strike. He said, I won't eat until you promise me you'll never go back to that school. I think probably had some adjectives in there as well that I've forgotten. Why didn't you go to Alabama and marry a football player? That's what we had envisioned for you. Sent their son, her brother, in to tell them, you've got to stop this, you're killing Mom and Dad. She ended up agreeing not to be directly involved, but she came back to school and was tangentially involved from that point on. Rosemary Hoy Wells is another example of somebody whose parents were not so understanding, nor were her sorority sisters. In fact, she tells the story of, this was her senior year, tells the story of her sorority sisters coming and requesting her pin because they had embarrassed the sorority. They wanted her membership. And she said to them, you know, I was thinking about going inactive, but you know what? I think I just changed my mind. I think I'm going to start wearing my pin everywhere I go, particularly on Sunday mornings. And she did. She wore her Tri-Delt pin out in front of the church for the next few weeks. So there were all sorts of pressures from coaches, from professors, from parents, from church members that were placed on these students, none of which had the desired effect. One of the things that was believed about the students within the church was that they were atheistic, communist in political orientation, paid by the NAACP, and basically up to no good. And one of the documents from this period that's most helpful for me in getting a sense for what the students themselves was thinking was written by Howard Romaine, who was one of the protesters, and published in the Sou'wester, the campus newspaper, in 1964. I'll let you read it. It's very eloquent about the theological and moral imperative for integration and why it is the students are returning to the church to sort of reveal where this particular church stands on this question. I won't give you details. I'll also tell you that there was a guy named Charles Murphy, who was a child of this church, but also a student at Southwestern, who, like others, felt very torn. And he wrote an article in the Sou'wester which basically said, you know, there's fault on both sides. I don't support what my church is doing, but it's possible that people are, you know, not being as respectful of the church as they might. So I don't want to give the impression that all Southwestern students or all students in Memphis were of a similar mind on this. The thing that was increasingly said about the students trying to get into the church between March 22nd and May 10th, 1964, was that their motives were wrong. They weren't interested in worship, despite the way they were dressed and everything else. They were trying to, their intention was to embarrass the church or to have a demonstration or something. One way to counter this was that the students photocopied an article from the Presbyterian Outlook called Motives Committee, which was a kind of spoof of a motives committee in a church, which had effectively, you know, filtered people out according to their motives, and essentially nobody was left. So this was a way of countering that charge. The story did not get local newspaper coverage until April 25th. This was about a month after it started, and it was in the Tri-State Defender, one of the weekly black papers of the day. It was front page news. And the first pictures did not appear till May 2nd, and they appeared in the Tri-State Defender as well, some of the pictures you've already seen. It was not until May 4th that the Commercial Appeal ran any stories about this. So as a historian, one asked, well, let's see, it was 6 weeks between the time these things started happening at a very visible spot in Memphis and the time they appeared in the paper. Why is that? Making the question even more interesting is the fact that the religion editor for the Commercial Appeal, Eleanor Kelly, had been reporting from Montreat, North Carolina, on a debate that was going on at the General Assembly about the site of the next General Assembly in 1965 and whether or not it should be carried out there since that church was practicing segregation. That was Second Press. So it's very odd that this is not appearing locally, but it's actually making more regional news. So the local problem becomes a PCUS problem, and the vote at the 1964 General Assembly was whether or not to change the site of the 65 GA based on the possibility that there could be demonstrations over a segregation policy in the home church. The move to change the site was narrowly defeated. But a strong admonition was passed along to Second Press to come in conformity with any church laws. The story finally goes national in the Presbyterian Outlook in April 27th. There's a editorial which basically says, can we risk having the General Assembly at a church where this sort of racial event might happen? The story really goes national on May 3rd. A guy named Carl Pritchett, who was a classmate of Jeb Russell at Davidson and who was one of the real progressives in the PCUS at that time, felt convicted by what the students were doing to such an extent that he felt like he needed to be with them. He writes a sermon that's preached in his absence on May 3rd to his congregation, telling him why he has to be there. and he wants to learn for himself what is really going on, and he wants to also lend them their support. This is a picture of Carl Pritchett, Jim Bullock, the pastor whose name escapes me for the moment, at Parkway Gardens, and some other folks. Ezekiel Bell is his name. And one of the phone calls he made before he left Maryland, Carl Pritchett, was to a friend in the TV industry. He said, you know, you might want to have some cameras in Memphis on Sunday morning. And indeed they did. Because, as I'll show you here, yeah, it went on the CBS Evening News that day, May 3rd, 1964. Now the problem was clearly beyond the church, beyond Memphis, even beyond the PCUS. One of the things Carl Pritchett did when he was here was report very carefully on the students that he met, because he was very aware, even his own in his own congregation, there were misconceptions about the students and their outlook. So he says, they're half Negro, half white, about their Presbyterians, Methodists, Baptists, Episcopalians, and not only that, every one of the students is a member of some church. There are five ministerial students, two are thinking of the ministry, and so on and so forth. In other words, these are church kids. These are not the Marxist warriors that you've been led to imagine. These aren't the atheistic people trying to attack the church. These are good church kids. The story continues to get national press. Different presbyteries and synods are now making resolutions to the General Assembly to change this place of the General Assembly. So there is publicity, almost all of it bad, going all over the country about this. Even in Christianity Today by the end of May 1964. Remember that letter that Robert Hussey sent to Rodney Sunday in Houston? Not a good idea. One of the results of that was that Rodney Houston took it upon himself to lead a campaign in the Senate of Texas to condemn Memphis, condemn Second Church for its policies, and to invite the General Assembly to meet in its own synod. And this made the papers in Dallas and Houston. So now the story has spread not only east all the way to Montreat and up to Virginia, but out to Texas as well. The same day that Carl Pritchett was outside and the news team was rolling, there was someone speaking from the pulpit here, reading a letter on behalf of the session, trying to explain to the congregation what the heck was going on and what it meant. The first thing they said is, please don't think that this is a big deal. People are overestimating the significance. This is not important. What you see is not really what you see, basically. But then they go on to say, to describe the policy from 1957, and this is how they describe it. In this current, So, 7 years ago, sensing that this church might eventually be singled out as a target for demonstrations, your session, after much prayer and serious deliberation, adopted a policy which it believed represented the sense of the majority of the congregation. You remember the policy, hopefully. It's only been about 10 minutes ago that I read it. It had nothing to do with demonstrations at the church, right? Remember that? So basically what the session has done, or at least the faction of the session responsible for this letter, is to change the subject. And it's interesting to me historically that after 7 years, which is a very short time historically speaking, this position that had been adopted and advertised in 1957 was so unpopular and untenable, it couldn't even be honestly articulated within the congregation. These people understood they didn't even have the support of the congregation if they had come clean about what it was they had actually been thinking in 1957. So they changed the subject. It's not about race. It's about people's motivations. And that's basically what they say. So they talk about all these demonstrations. And they talk about what it is that the students outside want to do, what they want to do. It is apparent from speech and action that the purpose is to promote the cause of social mixing of the races, and actually their desire is to walk arm in arm down the central aisle. I'm pretty sure, in all the interviews I did, I never heard anyone articulate the desire to do anything quite like that. This is obviously the figment of someone's imagination. but it was the institutional story that was being told to the congregation by the lay leadership of the church. And then they do something that is very interesting, because in all my research, it's the only biblical passage that is consistently used by those who want to keep people out of the church for whatever reason. They say it's not about race, but it has to do with motivation. And just like Jesus cleared the temple of people whose motivation was incorrect or they were profaning sacred space, that's what we're going to do. And so not only in Memphis, but in Jackson, Mississippi, and Birmingham, you have churches citing this passage as sort of a desperate effort to find some biblical sanction for their for what they're doing. Among the people, this is what one of the quotes from the letter read on this, May 3rd, we have seen no acceptable evidence that any of this group have a sincere desire to worship prompted by a genuine motivation. They're saying that not only about those well-dressed kids whose pictures you saw, but about a ruling elder in the Presbyterian Church, Vasco Smith, a collared clergyman of the United Methodist Church, and a teaching elder of the Presbyterian Church and minister Carl Pritchett. This was true in other places as well, particularly in Jackson, Mississippi. It started off about race, but in the end, it clearly wasn't about race, because you had bishops and pastors, white pastors from Chicago, being kept out because they wanted to protest the position of the church. So this is where the story gets really, really interesting. As you may know, in Presbyterian polity, there's a position called moderator. It's a moderator for the entire General Assembly, the entire church, and it's elected once a year for a one-year term. And the guy who was elected in 64 was Felix Geer, who was fairly an unremarkable choice, except that he had taught at Southwestern for 10 years and then become the pastor at Second Pres. So he knew the situation at the college and the church better than anybody in the entire denomination, probably. And he was the one who was going to have to decide what to do about it. The local presbytery gets involved, not so interesting, but basically they were powerless to do anything, and I think reluctant to do too much, because this was the largest church in the presbytery and contributed more to the presbytery than any other church. But then in January of 65, this controversy that had kind of been dormant for a few months because the student leaders had graduated and moved on, heats up again in January of 65. A Southwestern student named Roger Hart writes an editorial in Southwestern, basically says, if the GA meets in Memphis, you will have not only students, but pastors and others demonstrating in front of the church on a daily basis. So at that point, the protests resume as well, apparently not with Southwestern students at this point, but with local folks, NAACP folks. There are pictures, again, in the Tri-State Defender. The newspapers, which had been silent in April and May of 64, now start talking about this and editorializing almost every day. And so the pressure is not only from the NAACP and from students, but from the daily newspapers. Finally, in January of 65, January 21st to be exact, the pastors of the church, Jeb Russell and his three assistants, decide that they must do something. One of the great questions about this story is, what was Jeb Russell thinking and doing in the months between March 64 and March 65? And it's not entirely clear. My sense is that he realized he did not have the personal clout and power to make the session see his point of view, and he basically had to manage the situation. His greatest fear was a split in the church, which ironically is what happened. But in January of 65, he decided that things had gone too far, and his only recourse was to come out publicly against his own session. If you know anything about Presbyterian polity, that's not a real good career move, because the session can fire you, essentially, dissolve the relationship. And so, but he had passed his Rubicon, and the gloves were off, and he basically in this letter says, we cannot in Christian conscience allow our session to make the decisions they're making. And then he preaches a sermon. And by the way, so this is my way of saying that always behind Jeb Russell and his decisions were his brother and the large persona of his brother nationally. His brother was Senator Richard Russell, who was the senior senator by the early 70s, who'd been in Congress for like 40 years, who led the Southern faction who had opposed the Civil Rights Bill, who had written the Southern Manifesto, and basically was synonymous with massive resistance to change. I don't think Jeb shared his views, but I think he was loath to get in the public spotlight and bring unnecessary attention to himself or his brother. The sermon that he preached included three, that Jeb preached on January 23rd, included three notable things. One, he acknowledged what everybody who was really paying attention knew. This is the greatest crisis in the history of our church. He has this great line that I wanted to use as the book title of my book, but the editor didn't think it was catchy enough. We can't serve Christ with shut doors about the cross. But here's the real kicker. He says, to exclude anyone who comes because they're of another race, or because they're not suitably dressed, or because they're socialist, or atheist, or communist, is contrary to our standards. It's as if he says, okay, just for the sake of argument, let's just assume that the students out there holding Bibles and dressed to a T are really atheists trying to, and communists trying to infiltrate our church and undermine our civilization. They still have to come in. And so he really has an unassailable argument at this point, and you would think that the story would end here. People would basically say, you're right. But they don't. The other thing I want to mention is the missionary factor. Very interesting. Remember that question, are you African? It has to do with the fact that this was and is a church very proud of its missionary support, missions conferences. And there had been people of color in this sanctuary many times, but they had been people from around the world who represented the mission outreach of the church. But people from a neighboring zip code were not welcome because it was a different situation. It was the missionaries of the PCUS, in Congo in particular, who were perhaps most vocal of any other constituency in the church about the necessity of this changing. And this put people on the session in a really interesting position. They're trying to present themselves as devout, committed evangelical Christians. And the people about whom one can only stand in awe about their commitment are saying, you're wrong. But they did, both in April 64 and in November of 64. And the November 64 is a letter signed by the entire PCUS Mission Corps in the Congo. And it basically speaks specifically to Second Church and says, you need to change. This is unprecedented, to have a missionary corps in a foreign country speak to the domestic situation in a particular congregation. So Felix Geer is sort of waiting, hoping things will change, realizing he has to make a decision soon. He gets a letter from the clerk of the session here saying no change has happened. He makes the only decision he can, which is to change unilaterally, in an unprecedented way, change the site of the 1965 General Assembly. He does so with a lot of anguish because he knows people this is going to hurt. My hunch is that part of his decision was related to the fact that he visited the Congo in December of 1964. His daughter confirmed this with me, that when he went to the mission field, he was told in no uncertain terms, you've got to do something about this. So the church loses the meeting, and you would think, again, at this point, that people would relent and sort of change. That's not what happened. Doors continued to be closed in Memphis, according to the Presbyterian Outlook. I'll just say real briefly something about the women in this church. It's really difficult to get a sense what women were thinking because they're not represented in the from the pulpit or from the session, but I found a fascinating document at Montreat. Guy who, Bill Bynum, who is the librarian there, said, I got something I think you might be interested in. And he showed me these series of histories of the church written by the women of the church, typewritten documents. This is a paragraph from one of them in 1965. And it's not so subtle in its critique of the male leadership of the church at that time. And it turns out that this echo of dissent was actually reflective of a much larger pocket of dissent among men and women in the church, who ultimately decided that they needed to take their church back. And so an accord committee of the Second Presbyterian Church is developed. Their goals are to remain in the church, open the doors, and stop the foolishness. And the way they decide to do it is to change the way in which elders are elected or serve on the board. This has been a sort of a lifetime assignment. The idea is elders will rotate off for 3 years based on longevity of service. So the older members will rotate off. If that can be, if that solution can be procured, then end of fight. Because it was always only about a dozen members of a 40-person session that were controlling this. It was not a majority. So the problem is, guess who was responsible for calling a congregational meeting in a Presbyterian church? The session, right? So the session has to call the meeting at which their own power is going to be voted out. This was not going to happen. So they made it happen by gathering signatures of 25% of the congregation, which would force the session's hand. The session dragged its feet. It questioned whether these signatures had been gotten under duress, whether they were real people, whether they were old enough to vote, and so they had them vetted. In the end, they had to call this meeting. At the meeting, which was, I can only describe as contentious. I think that probably doesn't do justice to what the meeting was like, but it was ugly, I think probably is a fair description. Very emotional. And at the meeting, the vote that was taken to rotate eldership service passed by 932 to 598. Before the vote was even announced, the people that I call the hardline faction on the session resigned, and within a couple of weeks started meeting to start their own church, and within weeks after that, about 300 members of this church left to join Independent Presbyterian. And I know, because I know some of the stories from hearing interviews, that this split not only split the church, it split some families. That the split went right through the middle of families and maybe right through the middle of people as well. What one will hear, what I have heard, indirectly and directly, is from people who were there or think they know what happened, is that this was really not about race. That is, it was never about race. It was about their motivations. But even when the churches split, it wasn't about race. It was about liberal Sunday school curriculum or the way that the pastor was at such and such a church. But here's the reality. What we have to judge reality by what people say, but also what they do. And what the people did who founded Independent Presbyterian was adopt an article in their constitution which made it very clear that they wanted to maintain segregation. And it's Article 3, Paragraph 2. And it reads, believing that the scriptures teach that the separation of nations, people, and groups will preserve peace, purity, and unity of the church, it is the will of this church that its members and so forth will be compatible with the congregation. Even in 1957, the session members of this church were unwilling to refer, allude to the Bible as a basis for their position. In 1965, some of the same men feel like they need to do it because the pressure is upon them so much. The good news is that, some more bad news. Okay. Was the constitutional basis of the church, the way the church, independent I'm talking about now, presented itself for a long time was in terms like this. This was a statement on the church's website until recently, and basically says this is the way I read it, it wasn't about race. It was about, you know, trying to get back to the old-time religion, which had been lost in the denomination, and we wanted our own fresh start and so forth. And one can understand the desire to present one's origins that way, but it's in conflict with the demonstrable facts of the case. And so the good news is that the people who are leading the church now, to a large extent, see that. And I put under the new leaders both Richie Sessions, whom you've met, but also John Hardy, who was the pastor in 2006-2007, and who had a very, I think it's fair to say, unpleasant experience at the church, but an experience that was crucial to Independent being in the place it is today. And if you want to learn more about that, buy the book. I'll stop there. I don't know how long I've talked. I feel like it's probably been too long. But thank you for your attention. Sure.